an alcoholic.
Hi, Jen.
First, I want to thank you for asking me to share my story, my experience, strength, hope, what it was like, what it's like now, what happened. So I'll start with the statistics of my life. I got sober in North County, San Diego. My sobriety date is September 9th, 2018. That is my only sobriety date up until this point, but I'm not naive enough to think that if I don't follow this program or stay close to the middle, that that couldn't change. I have a beautiful family today that I was at risk of losing. I have a career that I was at risk of losing. And if I'm 100% honest, I would have lost my life. Having said that, that is not how it started. I grew up in California. I grew up with two amazing parents. Neither one of my parents drink. My mom never drinks. She takes a couple sips and she's giddy and that's it. She's a educator. She retired as a principal. My father, my papa, my dad, he is a self-employed contractor. And he would come home every day from work, working sometimes in 100 degree weather, walk to the fridge, open it, and pour himself a glass of milk. That's what he drank every day. We didn't understand it because it was hot. Who drinks milk when it's hot? My papa did. That's not to say that I wasn't around alcohol. I grew up in an Irish, Catholic, Mexican family. There was alcohol at every turn. We had a stocked bar in our house all the time. As a kid, I remember the first time I tasted beer. We were in Hawaii with the grandmas, and it was my cousin, my sister, and I. We were probably 6 and 7 years old, and we went into the bathroom because we were told to get ready for dinner. And I don't know what made us, but the beer was sitting there, and well, I was the oldest, so I was told I had to go first, so I did. I didn't like the taste of it, but for some reason, we passed it around, and we giggled, and when the adults came in to get their beer, they realized it was empty, and they had 3 kids that were giggling about drinking it. And of course, that became the family story. Looking back now, it's a disturbing story, but at the time, they all thought it was very entertaining. I never quite fit in as a kid, or I thought I didn't fit in. I was different. I always had a feeling that I was not enough. I couldn't measure up. And no matter what I did, I somehow didn't meet the mark. I was a very driven kid. I was, I'm pretty smart, so that I had that going for me. My sister was beautiful. I was overweight and uncomfortable in my own skin. And that has carried through my entire life. My parents loved us, that my parents are still married. They have a great relationship. My papa is in the stages of dementia, so that is a different experience for us right now. When I talk about my dad during this story, you will tell that he is that one person that I have always put on a pedestal. And he will remain on that pedestal for my entire life. I grew up in Northern California. I went to private school all my life, from kindergarten through 2 college degrees. I didn't drink. I followed all the rules. I didn't lie about where I was going. I lied one time in high school. And we drove to the party and I made everybody leave because I was so scared my parents were gonna find out. Guess what? They weren't going to, but in my head they were. My sister wanted to kill me that night. And I drank a little my senior year. And then my freshman year, I had decided in the 7th grade what university I was going to go to. I worked very hard. I got into Creighton. That's where I went. And I stayed on the path that I'm supposed to stay on because I had to meet expectations that I put for myself and what I felt my family had put for me. towards my third year in college, I started drinking. Because when I drank, I was comfortable in my own skin. I could talk to other people. I could be around people. Yes, I was obese. Yes, I wasn't comfortable in general. But I put that in my body, and I was okay. I could keep up with everybody because I could drink as much as everybody. I thought that was fantastic. Later found out that's probably not the best thing to put. And that's kind of how my college went. I did what was expected of me. I finished school. I decided in 2003, and this is important to share this part of the story, because it changed me. I had gastric bypass, and for you, those of you that don't know, that is where your stomach is surgically altered. And so now, I am not to drink alcohol, but I'm an alcoholic. I may not know it at the time. And so as soon as that was done, I didn't drink. I continued doing exactly what was expected. I went back to school, got my second degree, met a man who was 16 years older than me, lost about 120 pounds or so, and ended up moving to San Diego and marrying that person. Now when I drink, I can't drink like I drank before because the alcohol absorbs into my system very, very quickly. And I go from being coherent to blackout to passed out. When you are surrounded by alcohol all the time, because when I was living, when we lived in San Diego, my ex-husband's friends were all major distributors of major alcohol companies. So we got to go to a lot of events, a lot of private events. We were also part of gourmet clubs, so I cooked and paired food and did all that. And it never crossed my mind that when I drank and I turned really red and I couldn't remember what happened and then I'd pass out, but that was a problem. Because I would go to the car, fall asleep, and come back about 3 hours later and just pick up where I left off, almost in perfect sentence. We ended up having 2 beautiful babies back to back, and I kept it together. I didn't drink much. I did what I was supposed to do, met their needs. And then my ex-husband was laid off from his job for getting into a fight and drinking. And then I became the sole responsibility of carrying the family. And from that point on, all I heard was, you're not enough. You're not pulling your weight. You're ugly. You're useless. The more I heard it, the more I felt it. The more I heard it in my own head, the more I drank. I'm not an alcoholic because of the verbal or physical abuse. I'm an alcoholic because I have an allergy and a spiritual malady. That is why I'm an alcoholic. Nothing can take that away. So my family doesn't believe in divorce, right? I mentioned Catholic, Irish, Mexican. We kind of just push right on through. It got to the point that was not an option for me anymore. And my ex-husband said, go to rehab or I'm taking the kids. And I thought, well, that seems dramatic. You're the one that got the DUI with the kids in the car. I've done jack crap. So what do I do? Do I go to rehab? No, I got a divorce attorney. And I filed for divorce. I, at the same time as filing for the divorce, I lost my job. Because I was drinking to the point where I could not complete my work. I could go see my patients, do what I needed to do. But when I got home, I couldn't complete the charts. And my boss not only knew that there was turmoil at home, because they saw the marks, they also knew I was drinking. Whether I hid it or not, it didn't matter. But like a good alcoholic, I had rules. I didn't drink after a certain time. I didn't ever drink when I was working. And I followed the rules. The problem is as you drink, the more you drink, the less my tolerance was, and I couldn't keep up. When we ended up in the divorce, I ended up having to breathalyze to go pick up my kids. I ended up in a situation where I had to fight to get 50-50, and I couldn't understand that. So not in my realm to understand that, I guess, at the time. Truth is, very easy to manipulate those alcohol assessments. I'm not proud to admit that, but it is, right? You learn to answer the questions correctly, you pee in a cup. All I had to do was keep it together for 3 months. I couldn't do it. But again, I'm not an alcoholic, you see, because it was my birthday. And so, of course, I needed to drink. Like, I don't, that makes sense. Ultimately, we ended up with 50-50 custody, and my life went on. One day, I came home from work, and Papa's sitting on my couch. He drove 5 or 6 hours straight, got to my house. He always had a key to my place, and was sitting on the couch, and I thought, oh, crap. I didn't have time to clean up. I didn't have the kids because we were on a 5-2-2-5 schedule. So there was a run where I wouldn't have them for 5 days straight, right? And then there's a run where I'd have them for 5 days straight. And all he said to me, and he had a piece of paper neatly written in his perfect printing. And he said, you're drinking too much. You're not supposed to be drinking. And I said, well, I'm not drinking. And he reached to the side of the couch and pulled up a bag. And he says, I found this throughout the two-bedroom, two-bath apartment. And I was like, how long have you been here? That was the question that popped in my head, not, you're right. And he said, and he turned the paper around and he had a pros and cons list. You can drink with the pro, and all the cons. You're going to lose your kids. You're going to lose your family. You're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your life. Is it worth it? Now, one would think that that would be the time that you kind of wise up. That is not what happened in my story. I drank for another year. I just got better at hiding it, right? I got better at making sure that when I stashed the bottle, they were in different places. I made sure that I knew who was coming and when by asking very strategic questions. I did follow the rules. If I had custody of the kids, I didn't drink. If I needed to work, I didn't drink. And that is how 2017-2018 went, of me just drinking. And now I have nothing to blame but myself, but I can't figure out why I can't stop drinking. Why can't I fit in? What is wrong with me? You know, I think back on all the times that I should have gotten a DUI. I should have gotten arrested. I didn't. I would finish my day before I got divorced. I would finish my day early and I'd go to grab lunch. But wherever I grabbed lunch, mind you, I always had a bar. And I could always order drinks, get in the car and go pick up the kids. Like, sanity-wise now, I'm like, what were you thinking? What right do you have to do that? I didn't care. And if you would have asked me, I would have told you I wasn't selfish or self-centered or self-seeking. But I was. 2018, I stopped following the rules because I'm a hospice nurse by trade. I have helped multiple families and people pass with dignity and grace. And I say we had custody of. That's not... Sorry, George, I shouldn't say it that way. But my dad had a cousin named George who got dementia and he had no family. And so he was either going to become a ward of the state or we took responsibility. And I told my dad, we have to take responsibility. Just move him to San Diego, I'll take care of him. And that's what happened. So for about 10 years, I took care of George. George was about 74 and he kept, it's not funny, it's a little funny. He would escape from the locked facilities. They would find him in trees. They would find him on top of cars. They would find him miles away down dirt road. And I was constantly getting calls saying, George is out. I got a call from the cops one time because he had climbed a tree and they couldn't get him down. He's 74 with Parkinson's. How the hell did he get up in the tree? Who's watching him was my question. Mm-hmm. So I get a phone call that says, hey, we sent George to the hospital. And I'm thinking, fantastic. This was my brain thinking, fantastic. I can get him on hospice. I can get extra services. I can keep better eyes on him. This is great. My friend goes to admit him and she calls me and she says, you need to get here right away. And I'm like, I can't. She's like, Jen, he's in the ICU. And I said, no, he can't be in the ICU because he has an advanced directive and the hospital has it. And I get there and George is on life support. There's no reason for him to be on life support. I failed him. That is the first and immediate thing that I think. I have failed him. He should be able to die in peace, and now he's on a machine. And I have to call my papa and say, hey, this is what happened. At no point did I think, hey, the hospital knew what they had. They made the mistake. It was my fault. Immediately my fault. So we had to make the decision to turn off his life support. And the reason I share that is this is where I spiraled. This is where everything crumbled for me. I turned off his life support, and you know in the movies where they do that and you like listen to the beeping and then it flatlines and it's all done and it's all pretty and nice? That's not necessarily reality. And so George suffered for 7 days, and I sat there at his bedside for 7 days. And it was my fault. So I would sit there with him, and then I'd go back home, and I'd put Papa to bed, I'd put the kids to bed, and I'd go into the bathroom and drink until I could go to sleep because of the guilt and the fear. So my ability to follow my own rules went right out the window. Once George passed, everybody left. The girls went to their dads for 5 days, and Papa left, and I was alone. And I drank for 5 days straight. I couldn't stop. I took a leave from work. I called people. I said things I shouldn't say that I don't even remember saying. And I got to the point where it didn't matter. I didn't eat. I didn't sleep. I passed out. I didn't even feed the dog. Then the girls came back, and here's the thing, once you get to that point, your rules don't matter anymore, right? So I started having a mommy cup. We'd go to the pool, mommy had a cup. Nope, can't drink out of that cup. So I proceeded to drink around the clock. I could go to work, but then work started to wander. I never drank while I was working. But you know when you drink so much, it's literally coming out your pores? That's what happened. People were like, what is that? Why do you smell like? And I was like, what? No, it's fine. I remember one day I dropped the kids off at school and I had the day off, and I went to Walmart to go grocery shopping. Really what I was doing is I knew the kids weren't coming home and I was gonna have 2 days to drink because I didn't have to work for 2 days. It was 8 o'clock in the morning, I went to Walmart, I got food because you can't just go through the checkout line with straight alcohol at 8 o'clock in the morning, because then you're an alcoholic, people. You have to do other stuff first. So I grabbed, you know, everything that I wanted, went to the checkout, and I'm just, you know, being myself, and the lady goes, oh, we don't sell alcohol at this time, you'll have to wait. And I was like, what the? And I got mad at the lady for telling me that. Irrational, I know. So I refused to buy anything because now I'm in my feelings, and I walked across the street to Albertsons. I drove across the street to Albertsons and spent twice the amount of money to get the exact same stuff that I wanted. And really, I didn't want any of the food. I just needed the beverage. The girls came home. That was in September. They came home on the 7th. We went to the pool on the 8th. I drank the entire time. I passed out at some point. The next morning was Sunday, September 9th, and I'm laying on the couch. I am literally sick. I want to puke. My chest hurts. My head hurts. Everything in me hurts. And Aubrey, you guys have all met her, the brunette, the wired one, 8 years old, comes up to me and says, Mama, can you play with me? And I said, I don't feel good. And Emma was 9 at the time, came up behind her, put her arm around her and said, let's go, Aubrey. Mama's sick again. I'll play with you. And I saw the disgust in Emma's face and the hurt in Aubrey's face as they turned and walked away. And I thought, what am I doing? And I don't know what made me. If you would ask me to this day, it was divine intervention. Because literally at that moment, I said, God, help me. I need help. I can't stop. And I whispered it barely out loud as I was laying there on the couch. And I didn't drink that day. And I didn't drink Monday. And I didn't drink Tuesday. But by Tuesday, I was not sure how I was gonna get through. So I decided in my infinite wisdom that I was gonna go middle of the day in a very part of North County Oceanside, which I had no business being in my scrubs, to an AA meeting, right? I walk in. Every person in there is covered in tattoos, crazy hair. They look mean as I don't know what. I look nothing like them. I don't sound like them. I won't speak to anyone, and I sit in the very corner chair by the exit door, watching, going, these are all prisoners. I'm going to get robbed or murdered. Well, I was that dramatic. You guys, I'm not even joking. That is exactly what I thought. Sat there, I listened, bolted. The second they wanted to hold hands and sing Kumbaya, I was out that door. I got to my car, but I didn't drink. And I thought, okay, all right, I made it another day. So Wednesday, in my infinite wisdom again, I don't know why, I went back to that prison-filled, disgusting, smoke-filled area, and I sat there for another meeting. At that exit door, didn't speak to anybody, and needed to get the hell out because they were all alcoholics and I was not. I just needed to slow down. Mm-hmm. And then I decided, okay, these are not my people. But let me call. I knew one friend who a couple years before, I had called her drunk. I don't remember doing it because, again, remember I was a blackout drinker. And a caller and a texter. Never a good combination. I called her and I said, I went to two AA meetings. I don't understand what you see in these people. They're all criminals, convicts. I'm telling you, I don't fit in. And she's like, where the hell did you go? And I told her, and she's like, why would you go there? And I was like, I don't know. And she goes, look, I'm picking you up for a meeting. I said, you cannot pick me up tonight. I have the kids. I have the kids for 2 days, and then I don't have them for five. She goes, great, for the next 5 days, stay sober for the next two, check in with me, and then on Friday, you're going to go on a circuit with me. And I'm like, what's a circuit? I don't understand what you're saying. So my first meeting was at the beach in Encinitas. And hey, these people weren't so bad. I didn't like what you guys were saying, and I still was not an alcoholic. In fact, I don't even think I would say my name. Because I was self-centered, self-absorbed, and afraid somebody would recognize me, say something, or point at me. Mm-hmm. Because I was uncomfortable. And then I went to a women's meeting on a Monday night. Again, I would only say, hello, my name is Jen. Because in San Diego, every meeting starts by you introducing yourself around, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to say, I'm an alcoholic, I'm whatever. I wasn't doing that. Tuesday, I walked in to a backyard meeting at a house of a man named Bill. I'm like, we're going to some guy named Bill's house? Fantastic. This sounds safe, too. That will become my home group to this day. They're on Zoom because of COVID. We just never went back live. Bill would eventually become my sponsor. He is not my first sponsor. And they would describe me as angry, untrusting, and didn't want to let go of any anger that I had. In fact, they used to change my name on Zoom to, instead of Jen, it was the girl who trusts no one. Like, that's what they did to me. Out of love, I'm sure. So for 30 days, I refused to say I'm Jen, I'm an alcoholic, to the point where at the women's meeting, they had to have a business meeting to discuss. I found this out years later. What they were going to do about me because I refused to say I was an alcoholic. And one of the old-timers said, we let her keep coming. Just let her keep coming. I got a sponsor within our first week because you guys told me to. I don't know what I'm doing. All I know is that you guys are supposed to teach me how to drink. I'm supposed to stay here for a few days. You're going to tell me how to drink like a lady, and then I'm going to go back right out there and do that. So when I heard that this is a lifetime commitment, could not understand that. What do you mean? How am I not going to drink when my kids graduate high school? How am I not going to drink at this social event or that social event? That's what I thought. I did it. I got a sponsor. I met her every Tuesday. We read the book. We got to the part where I was supposed to, the fourth step. Right? The fourth step. You want me to what? You want me to write down everything that I've done wrong? well, like, you're going to judge me on that. I'm pretty sure. And then you want me to read it to you? We're going to have to slow down just a little bit. And I did it. And like everybody had told me, you're going to feel so much lighter after you get through it. And I did. And what I found is that if I just shut up and listen, I hear what I need to hear. I take the step that I'm supposed to take. And yeah, I came into AA finding out every reason why we were different, why we're not the same. And now today I can tell you I always find a reason on why we're similar. And the reason I do that is I need that for me. I need similarity. I need to know that I'm not alone in this. Sobriety hasn't been easy, right? There's no guarantee in life, but I can tell you this. I have amazing people in my life that have helped me get through some really scary things. When I came in, I didn't understand what I was doing. I didn't understand that I could trust and rely on perfect strangers. I was 6 months sober, and I didn't tell anybody I was in sobriety, not my family. I would go to family events still mixing drinks and handing them out because I couldn't. I was afraid of failure. If I failed, then I'm a failure again. So I'm 6 months in, the kids are with me, and I need a meeting. Something had happened, I felt unsettled, I knew I needed a meeting, and I didn't know what to do. I always went to a Friday night meeting when the girls weren't with me, and so I decided to put them in the car with their cell phones and their headphones, and remember, they're 10, 9 and 10, and we walk into my regular meeting, and a very large man named Willie was standing there, and he would always go, "Hi, Jen." And I looked at him, and he said, "You okay?" And I said, "I need a meeting. If I don't have a meeting, I'm going to drink. But I have my kids. My kids are with me. They'll be really good. They'll put headsets on." And he looked at me, and he goes, "Hey, you're right where you need to be. Girls, go get cookies." And he looks at me, and he said, "If anybody says anything to you, you tell them to come see Willie." And I thought, okay. It was an open meeting. And you know what I found out? The people in that room who had been loving me for 6 months loved my kids. They were sneaking them cookies. We didn't even have soda at the meeting, but somehow I looked around and the kids had soda. And I'm like, what is happening here? I'm losing control. Then one of my friends, he went up, Mr. Steve is what the kids call me, said, "Hey, when you're not with your mom, every Friday after the meeting, we go to Denny's and we have ice cream. You should tell her you should get to come." And I'm like, what the? You can't go around the mom. And you know what? It was the best decision we made. We went to the meeting after the meeting. The kids literally think AA is for them. Like, you've seen them here. They think everybody's their friend. This is their party. And that's how I got through my first year of sobriety. And learning the steps and realizing that, hey, I'm going to screw up. But am I going to own it, or am I going to hide it? What am I going to do? And what I do today is when I make a mistake, I own it. I own it and I try to fix it. I'm not perfect at it. I have character defects. I'm still super insecure. I have a temper. I'm Mexican and Irish. Like, I don't, it's in my blood. But I do try to curb it. I do try to stay between a 4 and a 6, like my sponsor says. I know you guys tease me, that's a very short range, but I still need that short range. I had a schedule. I was doing my thing. COVID hits. Now, AA is supposed to always go, but AA stops going. We couldn't go in person anywhere. And I got into my character defects and decided I wasn't going to do Zoom because I didn't like it. I didn't appreciate it. I didn't like it. I can handle this on my own. As a hospice nurse, watching people die younger than me left and right, older than me left and right, with something that I could easily bring home, I thought, I don't need to do meetings. God thought otherwise, because what did God do for me? We're outside playing with the kids, and the little neighbor girl, little Emma, comes bebopping down the street. "Nurse Jen, Nurse Jen, it's my mommy's birthday." And I was like,
okay.
And she was with her grandma, and her grandma leans over and she says, and I never knew, and I had known Tara and Dave for a couple years now, but I didn't know. Not her belly button birthday, her AA birthday. And my head spun around. And I said, what did you say? She goes, we're all in AA. And I was like, no, wait, what? I'm in AA, and I didn't share that openly. And from that point on, the path between our two houses, it was as if we were one big house. And that is what happens in my life when I stay the course. And sometimes if I just shut up and listen, I hear what I need to hear. And Dave is here right now. Dave is Tara's husband. And Tara is my absolute best friend. She knows everything about me. She'll call me on my BS. She will have my back. But most of all, when I needed AA, she was there. And that's how I got through COVID. And you know, the meetings did open back up. Life went on as usual. But for me, for the type of person I am, I needed that connection. And God provided that for me, and I know that now. You know, AA has brought so many blessings in so many different aspects of my life. You know, I'm able to be present for my kids. I'm able to play with them, and Aubrey has a lot of energy. I'm able to be part of plays and things that I would have never been able to do, picking them up at 8 or 9 o'clock at night because they had a game or a match or they had rehearsal. I'm telling you, in my drinking days, it was 4 o'clock we had to be locked in, done. I wasn't going back out. Now I'm just old and I don't want to go back out, but that's a whole different conversation. During my sobriety, I've learned that things are going to come our way and we have to adjust and deal with them. And in 2022, I got a phone call that said, it was a phone call no mom wants to ever get. And it was my daughter, and she was screaming, I'm not safe. Come get me. I'm scared. Come get me now. And I remember thinking, how can I get to her house the fastest way I can get to her? And at the time, I had been dating my husband for a couple years. And I called him and I said, Aubrey's screaming. Something's really wrong. And all he said to me is, please don't go to his house alone. And I'm thinking, I'm going. But here's what the program taught me, that sometimes my very first thought, my instinct is wrong. My first thought is not always correct. It's that second thought that comes in that's the one I need to listen to. That's what I have found to be true for myself. And to this day, sometimes I can be reactionary. I know that shocks many of you in this room that I would be reactionary. So I took his advice. Anthony said, do not go there alone. And so I called the police and we got there. And then it ensued a year of custody battles to try to keep these kids safe. And in that time, there was points where I thought, why am I doing this? What is happening? I can't keep up. And somehow I would hit my knees. I would tell my sponsor and I'd be told the same thing. Stay the course. Do the steps. Pray for him. If I heard that one more time, I was going to choke somebody. Because I was resistant to that little piece of advice. Because again, I am stubborn, right? I am stubborn. I still am. And we got through it. I do have custody of the kids. They are safe. They're older. They're opinionated. Like their mother. But why I share that story is there's going to be things in sobriety that shock us to our core, right? That we don't think we're going to be able to get through. And that's what I found to be true. And when I'm on the brink, I've learned that I have to reach out more. That's what I've learned to do. And I haven't been doing that here. If I'm 100% honest, I moved here in August. I've been here for 9 months. I got married. I blended a family. We have 4 daughters. That's a lot of personalities. My husband and I have never lived in the same household. He's a gentle giant, you know, he really is, but he's hard to live with. Sorry, I love you. He is. We argue different. I'm a talker. I want to work it out right then and there. Let's get this over with. And he's a shutdown, and I don't do well with shutdown, right? I also left my community, my AA community, that I had set meetings Monday, Tuesday, Saturday, Friday. I was my ladies I sponsored, whatever. Everything I left and moved, and I came here. And I didn't grip on real quick. I kind of stayed on the outskirts. I did. I'm honest about that. I did start joining a home group. I would come to Fridays. I always loved coming to Fridays, but that was it. That was what I would do. So somebody asked me, why don't I join Tuesday? And I thought, I can't do that. Okay, yes, I can. And then about 2 months ago, at a Friday meeting, one of our home group members looked right at me and he said, are you okay? And my first instinct kicked in, and which was to lie and say, yep, I'm great. But I didn't. I said, no, I'm not okay. And I started to cry. And he said, sit down. And I thought, oh, crap. And he told me, you're on the outskirts. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. And I was like, you're 100% right on that. You are 100% right. And I admitted to him, I had been sitting in that room 2 weeks prior with Emma sitting next to me, and I had a plan. I was going to go drop her off at home, and I was going to leave to go drink. I'm coming up on 7 years, and I made a plan while in an AA meeting on what I was going to do. And you know what happened? During that meeting, the speaker shared about that exact experience. And I thought, what? Huh? Wait. And I didn't go home and do that. What I did go home and do is pick up the phone and tell my sponsor what I was thinking, that I had a plan. I admitted to my husband that I was falling apart, that I had a plan, and he was like, well, what was your plan? So I told him, of course. But that's why I say I'm never too far away from knowing that a drink is just right there if I'm not willing to pick up the tools and do the work that's expected of me, if I'm not willing to get honest. And had Steve not stopped me that day and I had lied like I had been doing, I don't know what would have happened. I can honestly say that. I don't know. And here's the truth. We have to work the program. We can't just stay on the outskirts. And when I work the steps, when I really work the steps, I know what I'm supposed to do. When I pick up the phone when I'm feeling squirrely, I get the answer. I may not like the answer, but I get the answer. And I will admit, sometimes my sponsor's answer is, Anthony's right, and I hate that answer. I really do. But you know what? He is right. And the woman that came into this room who didn't want to be an alcoholic, who didn't trust anybody, who was scared of everything, especially of failing, isn't that same person. I see similarities in every person, from the doctor, the lawyer, the convict, the teenage kid that's in here. I see a similarity, and that's what I do. I focus on step 10, because here's the truth for me. I have to self-check every day, because if I let that build up, I will get a resentment, and that resentment will take hold, and I'm screwed. And that's what was happening right about the time that home group member asked me if I was okay. I had a huge resentment at 2 very specific people, and I knew it. I love AA. I'm grateful that you guys didn't teach me to drink and send me out, because the truth is I'd be dead. I wouldn't have the life that I have. I wouldn't have my career. I wouldn't have my family. And I am so grateful, and I know sometimes I sound like I'm on a pink cloud because I get told that all the time. I love AA. I have no problem admitting that I'm an alcoholic. Do I do it at work? Not so much. But when I'm asked, I don't have a problem admitting it. And before I would. I wouldn't own that, because I saw it as a negative thing. I remember my first year of sobriety, we were going on a family vacation. That's not stressful. A bunch of us on a cruise ship. That's not stressful. And I was 7 months sober, and my sponsor was like, fantastic. She's like, you'll do great. And I was like, okay. And one of my dearest friends, he goes, you know, there's AA meetings on the ship. And I'm like, the hell they are? We're going to be in the middle of Mexico. Like, there's no AA in Mexico. He's like, Jen, what did you just say? In my perfect blonde moment, huh? Wait, what? Sure enough, when we got on the cruise ship, I opened the little, whatever that thingamajigger is, you know what I mean, the daily thing, and it was like, Friends of Bill. And I was like, huh, there's an AA meeting in the middle of the ocean. And you know, I'm naive a little bit, okay guys? I went to that meeting, and here's what I found. In the middle of an ocean, there's people who can't drink, who are in the program, who, yes, we would see each other on the ships and we'd do like a little head nod. And guess what? That got me through those 7 days, because I needed that. I was newly sober. I didn't know what I was doing there. It was a free-for-all around me. We were on Carnival. It was like nonstop party. I mean, I'm pretty sure I smelled alcohol in my nostrils for like 2 weeks following the cruise. But I did it. And I found that wherever I go, there's a handy dandy app on my phone that will tell me where there's a meeting. And you know what? Thanks to COVID, there's very few things that I can thank COVID for, but the Zoom meetings. I can say, hey, I can get on a Zoom meeting now, because guess what? I do it every Thursday, because I continue to go to my original home group on Thursday nights, even though it is at 10 o'clock our time, because those people on that screen know me better than anybody, and they know when I'm lying. They know when I'm telling the truth, and they know when I'm starting to get squirrely. And you know what happens when I start to get squirrely? I pull away. I start to isolate. I don't engage. I breeze in 5 seconds before the meeting, and I'm out by the time we're done saying, you know, keep coming back. I'm already out. And I've stopped doing that in the last 2 months. And you know what I found? I love my home group here. I love going to Saturday night. At first, I was like, Saturday night? Like, really? It's fantastic. Tuesday night's here. I get to joke. I get to laugh. There's so much good sobriety, and that's what I need. I need to hear the message that is in this book, and I need to have friends that know me, who tease me when I do show up late so that I turn beet red because I was running late from work. Thank you, Jonathan, for pointing that out that day. I appreciate you. I need that. I need the joking, because I was starting to feel alone. Surrounded by people, I was alone. And that can happen in sobriety. But guess what? We have to make the choice to be engaged. And I choose to be engaged. I choose to say yes. I choose to stay sober. The woman that bought me my AA book, who took me on that 5-day run, said to me, write your sobriety date in your book. And I said to her when she said that, what if I have to change it? And she goes, what if you do? But what if you don't? And that's what I took away. And I kept that. I write in my book. I keep things in here that are important to me. And all I know is to work this program, to lean on people who know better than me. And there's a lot of people that know better than me. And that's okay. I get to show up and be there to help my family, to help my friends. I'm not as selfish and self-centered as I was, right? We still battle that every day, we do. But it's this program that's given me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And here's the other thing I found, that I have to find acceptance in whatever happens. And if something is not right, it's probably me that's the problem. I need to own what my part is. And it doesn't matter what anybody else's part is. In fact, Emma told me the other day, I said, you need to own your part. And she goes, I'm sick of you saying that. Other people have parts too. And I said, well, that doesn't matter right now. We're just talking about your part. But I find myself doing that too sometimes. And so I will continue to learn. I will continue to grow. And for every person in this room who has shown love, acceptance, greeting, thank you. Thank you for being a part of my sobriety. Thank you for helping me stay sober. And thank you for letting me share my story.